I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. In the midst of Poetry Month, I'm joined now by Sho Yamagoshiku. He's just published a new collection of poetry, Shima. I'll ask him about what the word Shima means and how the poems in this book relate to that idea of community and where one comes from and how one belongs despite the distance between generations. We'll talk about his poetry and how the idea of home, whether his own or his ancestors', is reachable or even understood. We'll also talk about the idea of roots, dreaming, and how he writes. Sho Yamagoshiku is an independent writer and researcher. He joined me from Victoria, B.C. last month. This is his first poetry collection, and it's published by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Sho Yamagoshiku. Mr. Yamagoshiku, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Found this collection just fascinating and tremendously heartfelt. I guess the stuff that's been happening in and around me the last several weeks, I think, probably made me more attuned to reading it and reading between the lines, if you will. I guess the first question that you'll probably get on this book tour is what Shima means. Did I pronounce that right?
Yeah. So Shima is in Uchinaguchi, which is like the dominant indigenous language in Okinawa. It means different things. So island, community, but also more specifically, because it's also a Japanese word, so Shima also means island in Japanese, but in Okinawa, Shima is like your village, so the people who are from the same village of you are Shimanchu, so it's a way of sort of really tapping into like a local specificity of place.
And this place that you often refer to in the book is a place from which your ancestors come from, which you're trying to reach, not just physically, but I guess metaphorically as well. This idea of trying to go there or go back to the past or obtain some sort of connection to your roots, is that something that you've always considered or always thought about, or is this something that's happened more recently, say?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of the, like, conscious work, and then there's also something that's a push and a pull from sort of, like, my intention to do something and then something that's intending to do something with me. And I think at some point, I don't think I necessarily consciously knew I needed it, but at some point I found myself, you know, having to make sense of this sort of where are you from question. And I also realized that I think that journey is often conceptualized as one of like connecting to a place. And I realized that actually a lot of the work that I needed to do was a work of disconnection, of sort of like dislodging sort of ancestral fragments that remained with me that I just didn't know how to sort of like be free of. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of journey of where are you from is always to me a failed question. And so each place that I would attempt, it's almost like it's sort of, there's a magnetic pull that can sort of like pull that shard out of me so that then I can understand better who I actually am or what I'm meant to do in this lifetime.
So this reaching out, I find fascinating because a number of the poems in this collection are addressed to family members who are who have died. And so you're reaching out to some of them. Do you only do that in poetry?
No. I feel like it's, you know, I think initially this work was sort of a question of conjuring, a question of like, what is the ancestral practice, you know, where perhaps the dominant ways of thinking in my life or what I was taught in was that the dead are over there or gone or not accessible. And so as I sort of came into my being, I found those sort of boundaries were quite easy to, they're quite permeable and you know, time is not linear. And so as I started to fall into a time that was not linear more and more, and then it became this sort of, you know, this idea of being alone became impossible because I found, you know, in in very mundane ways, but also in occasionally in ways that are very sort of striking, that, you know, that the places and people, the things that I thought I no longer had access to are actually right there within me. So.
And so does that provide solace or answers even?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something strange with solace, because I think that there's, like, you know, at once it was a very solitary journey, because, you know, I would have sort of these, like, think about the word glance or glimpse, these sort of, like, moments of connection, but also, like, falling further and further out of line with the sort of, like, tangible world. But then also, the more I was sort of on the solitary journey, the more I was also in conversation always. Like, there was no, the theater of was the world. There was always sort of, you know, there was always a witness, and for better or for worse. So I think that I found, like, I think there was also working with my own, like, you know, what might be classified as depression or something, to think about how, you know, how I think about aloneness, and whether that's a failure or whether that actually might be something that is profoundly true, right, in my life.
Yeah. See, I find solace to be something that's peaceful and that would be welcome, I guess, in living the sort of lives that we live in big cities and the sort. I, you know, sleep at the end of the day or at the beginning of the night is a solitary experience, and I would think that would be enjoyable in a way. But as I'm reading the book and as I say all of this, I realize that there is a need for connection that emerges. And just take the photos, for example, that we see throughout the book. These are of family relations. A lot of these people, I would assume you've never met before, right?
I think everyone in that, all the photos are of people I've never met.
Yeah.
Some of them are of relations who I can know and name. Most of them are unnamed. And so the relations is through kinship rather than blood.
Sure.
Probably.
And if you had in your lifetime had met some of these people that are depicted in the photos, they'd be much, much older than you would have been at the time you would have possibly met them. So when you look at these photos, do you see yourself at all?
Do I see myself? I see something that's very familiar to me. I think that the photos in some ways are like anchors for the poems, and so I see something that I know. I don't necessarily know how I know it, but I know it. And so, I think that, yeah, so, and these are all people that, you know, it's, in some ways, they came forth to be part of the pool of poems, and so it wasn't necessarily, like, maybe curation feels like I picked them, which in a practical way I did, but when I try and, you know, turn off that sort of part of my mind and see, you know, who is present in these poems, and then I look, so they come from one album from my grandmother's sister, from pre-war photos, and so, yeah, so it's a strange sort of, like, both, I think, me being attracted to the photos because of their strangeness, but also their sort of the finding a piece of myself in them, I think.
Yeah, I can't help but think that we are our ancestors in a way, and a lot of people don't always realize that, or we know people that try to deny that, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was sort of a core thing that I struggled with, like, what is this, like, whether or not I choose to investigate my ancestors, I'm accountable and tied to them. And so I think the act of getting to know them or doing this work wasn't necessarily, I think initially I thought I'd find like, I think I wanted to become them. I think there was this sort of envy or desire, maybe a grass is green on the other side, like that, you know, another time or frame would be better. But I think ultimately it was that I needed to clarify my relationship to them. And so I needed to say, you stand there, I stand here. How do we, what can we offer each other, rather than sort of being in this muddied way? Because I think also I wanted things from them, and they also wanted things from me, because there are these unfulfilled sort of like urges or sort of like unseen emotions, these sort of things. And so I think the more that work is clarified, the more that I can have a, you know, what is, and it doesn't really have to do with whether they were good people or not. Mm-hmm. It has to do with whether I'm clear of sort of my, you know, where I stand with them. And so I think that that's, you know, I think ultimately having a clear and honest relationship with our ancestors, which sometimes means learning facts, but I think oftentimes it's more based on a sort of emotional clarity, can be very, you know, it can free us from some of the patterns of addiction or sort of like, you know, this sort of going in a circle of something that you can't satiate. So.
The other thing, Cheryl, I've been thinking about since I finished reading your collection is it's reflected in the poems, in some of the poems, about how the body itself, not just the mind, are affected by a lot of these thoughts, that a lot of the thoughts that you might have manifest themselves physically. I mean, roots is something that you talk about a lot throughout the book. They manifest themselves, I guess, in connections. The one visual that I recall from reading your book is the hair itself. You feel these things viscerally, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of like severing of body from mind from spirit, which is like, you know, one of the most profound, like, or maybe like meta like works that colonialism does to us. I think that when I started to realize that everything that was appearing in my body was also corresponding to this work, you know, like that no symptom in my body could I isolate from any of these, you know, and any of the sort of like ancestral work, like that everything was there for, I don't want to say a reason per se, but I want to say that there was a sort of logic that the pain or any sort of discomfort was always a door into something else that then, you know, it doesn't make it go away, but I think it makes it a much more interesting, thing, and also it clarifies to me the weight of history and why, you know, like the sort of, it wasn't ultimately, it was, or initially it was a nostalgia that drove me toward these things, but ultimately I realized that nostalgia was just sort of something that was clouding my ability to deal with the shadow, like the depth of the things that I had to reckon with in my life, right? So.
Yeah, that's another thing that I got out of your book is the perils of nostalgia. I mean, nostalgia can be great and fun even, but there is another side to it that I think a lot of us don't consider. You know, that it can't be great all the time, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Dionne Brand really shaped my thinking when I heard her speak against nostalgia, and I think that I looked around and I saw that a lot of the violence that was happening around me was nostalgia was one of the main sort of like the logics that kept it into place. And so, you know, whether that's nationalist violence or patriarchal violence or all these things, there's something about this belief in like that has had its control, you know, it's like this better place that then can be mobilized to, you know, keep us in sort of in line with like pretty terrible things. And so, yeah, I still live in nostalgia comes to me, and now I'm very consciously thinking about how you know, the things that I'm nostalgic for can create ways that I'm actually just refusing to see the ways that I'm implicated in systems of violence. And, yeah, it feels good, I think, because nostalgia always had this sort of, like, shadow side. Like, it wasn't, nostalgia has this sort of, like, there's a danger that I always felt, but mm-hmm. I wasn't really clear as to what that, like, why do I feel that? And I realized, you know, I mean, with this collection, for example, like, I think I grew up in Japanese-American, Japanese-Canadian community worlds, and there's always this nostalgia for Japan, and so the imperial power of the Japanese nation state that is, like, you know, has carried out so much violence against Okinawans, but also across so many communities across the Asia-Pacific, was always, like, by Japanese-Canadians or Japanese-Americans who had went through the incarceration, there was this, like, deep nostalgia for that, and I realized that that was, you know, it was haunting it still is haunting our community formations, and nostalgia often, you know, this sentimentality towards elders and mm-hmm. sort of things, which, you know, I want to be seen as a complicated person, not as someone who's like a simple good, but like the nostalgia often, I think, relies on sort of the collapsing of multiple emotions into one thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, I want to look at my elders as complex people, not as sort of like, oh yeah, like uncle who could do no wrong, you know, like that doesn't help any of us, because I don't want to be remembered like that either, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. What role does dreaming play in the shaping of your work? I mean, I ask that question because I don't get enough sleep, and so I don't dream enough.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, as a writer, as a poet, as an artist, I'm assuming, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that dreaming does play a part, does it, in your work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of, well, first thing I thought of is I used to smoke a lot of marijuana, and I never dreamed, and so the marijuana took my dreams, and I think that, because I was, you know, through the high, the dream would be there, but not sort of in my life, or in my sleep, and so, yeah, I think that part of the work of poetry is to inhabit a dream and not be beholden to what is sort of like the waking state and what is the dreaming state, like that everything has, you know, everything has this sort of potential to lead us into realms that transcend the sort of like logics of the physical body or what we think can be done. And so I don't think that necessarily means like anything can be done. It means like, how can I sort of continue to think of my spirit as something that's expansive? And poetry can be a tool for that. It can also be a tool for other things. It can be used for a lot of different things. But I think that dream, you know, the more I deepen sort of ancestral work, the less and less clear I am between what's a dream and what's not. And I think that is, I don't know, I think it helps take off some of that, like, you know, a dream is, like, I think in a cynical, maybe more sort of, like, westernized world, a dream is seen as, like, something that's fake or it's not real, and so I think the more we can give dreams sort of the expansiveness that they deserve, the more we can actually, like, refuse to be enclosed into obvious sort of, like, you know, things like nostalgia. Like, I think a dream is different than nostalgia, because a dream is, I mean, I think sometimes maybe it could be used interchangeably, but I think to me it's a dream where I'm not in control. I'm letting sort of, like, I'm in line with a creative, expansive force, and I can't make the decisions, where nostalgia is me trying to force a dream into a box that feels really convenient at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, you know, sometimes we need that. Like, sometimes that can be a coping mechanism, but ultimately I think the dream is a much more scary but also liberatory sort of, like, potential for a writing practice as well. But also, and I don't see that when I say writing practice or poetry, I don't necessarily mean anything to do with the page. I mean with the way we live our lives, right?
Mm. Yeah, because the way one lives one's life, that's interchangeable with the work itself, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the things. things I was most scared about with, like, thinking about what it meant to publish is I felt like it was, you know, I want poetry to feel like it seeps into everything, and there is no, like, you know, poetry can appear anywhere, right?
Yeah.
And so then all of a sudden thinking about it, it feels like putting a lock onto word publishing, which is, like, beautiful because there's this sort of support and, like, this reverence done to it. But how do I keep the words alive? How do I keep something that, you know, and I think craft can be a tool that keeps things alive, or it can be something that deadens words, right? And so, I think always making sure that a reading practice or a writing practice has nothing to do with a page or a word is, or not that it has nothing to do with it, but it is not confined to that is a challenge, but it's a good one.
What's the process of for you when you work with an editor? Because the writing can be solitary. You know, it's just you and the page itself. When you bring an editor in, what does that add, say, to one's poetry?
Yeah, so this is the first time, like, I hadn't really, like, worked with an editor on individual things. I hadn't really published individual things. So working with my editor, Kenesia Lubern, on this project was, it felt, you know, there's that sort of, like, you know, moment of talking on the page, but once again, it transcended that because I felt like I had someone who was witnessing and asking the most intentional questions about what I was saying, because poetry has this sort of, like, clarity, but it also has a complete loss of clarity at the same time. And so my editor was watching me through both those places and pushing me to the things I was doing that were not honest, I feel like. And so one of the main things was I was avoiding myself. I was avoiding claiming the poem. And so, and I think part of that came from my experience in the Okinawan diaspora, where I was taught that Okinawans didn't exist in diaspora. I was, like, the brutal colonization of Japanese diasporic spaces disappeared me. And so I was replicating that in my writing process. But of course I exist. I have flesh. I have thought. I have, like, dreams. I have all these things. And so, you know, I think the editorial process was being the most, it's like an act of extreme love when it's done properly, and it's also an act of extreme sort of like, critique isn't quite the right word, but it's like being present and reflecting my work back to me and seeing where what I actually feel, how the page is not, like, what is the difference between that sort of, like, deep place that I'm trying to touch and then what's happening on the page. And editor is like the guide for that, right? And mm-hmm. and you know, and that's a, I think when there's sort of like a trust that transcends sort of like any sort of like idea of like grammar or, you know, whatever, like it's a beautiful thing. And so I'm you know, these poems without Kenesia's sort of witness wouldn't have been possible, because I was scared of myself, and I needed that there was that sort of courage. Like, it's like, I think sometimes courage, if we can see ourselves through someone else's eyes, we can have courage to go to a different place. And so I think that's the gift that editing gave me.
Yeah, but boy, that's absolutely correct, not just in writing, but life itself. So this is a really thoughtful and beautiful collection. I'm so glad I read it, because I think I really needed it at this time. I so appreciate your time today. Thanks for this, and congratulations, and good luck with the book.
Amazing. Thank you so much for the thoughtful questions, and I really appreciate getting a chance to talk with you.
The book is called Shima. It's published by McClelland and Stewart. Its author, Sho Yamagushiku, joined me on the line from Victoria in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.